Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Ana Lilia Mejia of Popular Democracy in Action, who talks about the human cost of the proposed Trump Republican cuts to Medicaid and SNAP food assistance to pay for trillions of dollars in tax breaks for the rich. Raed Jarar, advocacy director with the group Democracy for the Arab World Now, who assesses the mixed outcome of President Trump's recent trip to the oil-rich monarchies. And Luke Pickrell, co-producer of the Democratic Constitution blog, who explains why he believes repairing the U.S. Constitution's democracy deficit is key to challenging Donald Trump's authoritarian power grab. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
South Sudan, with a population of 11 million people, gained independence in 2011 with the help of the United States. But 2 years later, the country was in a bloody civil war fueled by ethnic violence. The two leaders at the center of the conflict, South Sudan's president, Salva Kiir, and the nation's vice president, Riek Machar, formed a unity government in 2020 with the goal of organizing a future election. But since March, Vice President Machar has been under house arrest, accused of inciting an anti-government rebellion, and the country is on the verge of descending again into civil war. There's growing concern that renewed war in oil-rich South Sudan will set off a mass exodus of refugees that would overwhelm neighboring nations, Ethiopia and Sudan, both mired in their own wars and plagued by famine. In March, Uganda deployed troops to South Sudan to support Kiir's government. Amnesty International has condemned the involvement of Ugandan soldiers and called on the UN Security Council to renew an arms embargo when it expires at the end of May. There were 750,000 unhoused persons in the U.S. in 2024, up 18% from the year before, according to The Economist. The high costs and shortage of affordable housing is a major cause, along with cuts in rental assistance, which will only intensify under Trump, and the Congressional Republicans' proposed budget cuts on domestic spending. 35% of homeless people in the U.S. sleep outdoors rather than in shelters, a higher proportion than in most other wealthy developed nations. Last year, in the case Grants Pass v. Johnson, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that cities punishing homeless people for sleeping outdoors when they have nowhere else to go was not a cruel and unusual punishment prohibited by the U.S. Constitution. Since then, 163 communities across the U.S. have passed laws targeting the homeless for sleeping outdoors. A third of those laws are in California. In Fresno, violators can face $1,000 in fines and a year in jail. If the unhoused person refuses to go to a shelter, fines can escalate. Governor Gavin Newsom has urged California cities to clear out homeless encampments under bridges, in parks, and along city streets. Dennis Culhane of the University of Pennsylvania warned that filling jails and prisons with people whose only crime is having nowhere to live, criminalizing homelessness, won't solve the problem. Beyond the Bars is a Miami-based member-led worker center for people with criminal records and their families, the first labor organization of its kind in the U.S. The focus is teaching temporary workers who left the criminal justice system how to advocate for themselves and improve their working conditions. Typically, workers with criminal records were seen as unorganizable, observed Richard Wallace of the Chicago-based group Equity and Transformation, which organizes black workers in the informal jobs market. Catherine Pasley, founder of Beyond the Bars, along with a handful of staffers, are determined to shatter this false narrative, proving that these workers are not only organizable, but are potential leaders in the labor movement. According to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, 6 out of 10 people with felony convictions are unable to secure employment within 4 years of their release. Many formerly incarcerated people turn to temp agencies, and employers are well aware of how easy it is to exploit those with prison records. Temp workers do the same work as a full-time employee, but make less money. Beyond the Bars is now working with the University of Miami, Rutgers University, and Harvard Law School to conduct research into the temp employment trap for workers with criminal records. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Donald Trump and the Republican Party are now rushing to pass a House budget bill that will extend Trump's first-term 2017 tax cuts and make deep cuts to social safety net programs to pay for reductions in taxes that primarily benefit the wealthiest Americans. The Center for American Progress described the proposed budget as the largest transfer of wealth from the poor to the rich in a single law in U.S. history. Trump and the GOP say their budget cuts will only root out waste, fraud, and abuse. The House Republican budget bill calls for $880 billion in cuts to Medicaid and a $300 billion reduction in the SNAP food assistance program over the next decade. If the Trump austerity budget is signed into law, it would lead to as many as 13 million people losing their health insurance and some 9 million, including 4 million children, being cut off from food assistance. The Trump tax cuts will add $4 trillion to the nation's federal deficit, causing the Moody's rating service to recently downgrade the U.S. credit rating. Public opinion polls find that there's consistent and overwhelming public opposition to the proposed Medicaid cuts. Your reporter spoke with Ana Lilia Mejia, co-executive director of Popular Democracy in Action, that's organizing protests and lobbying campaigns to defeat the draconian Trump GOP budget. Here she talks about the human cost of these deep budget cuts being enacted to further enrich the nation's most affluent families.
Right now, members of Congress are debating a budget that can have catastrophic impact on our communities. We're talking about $4.5 trillion. In tax cuts that are poised to go to the wealthiest amongst us in exchange for austerity budget and safety net cuts that can have tremendous impact. So right now what's being proposed is a cut of close to $880 billion from Medicaid. Now, Medicaid is a program in which 80 million Americans depend on. Close to 41% of U.S. births are covered by Medicaid. Most of your listeners will likely know someone that receives Medicaid benefits. It's the elderly, it's the disabled, it's children whose parents have passed away. All of these impacted individuals will either face reduction in services or coverage or altogether lose eligibility. There's also a proposal of a 30% reduction in SNAP, which will impact 80 million Americans that depend on these benefits. We're talking about cuts that could be upwards of 50% less benefits for SNAP recipients. So imagine half of a plate of food will disappear for 9 million people across the United States. And all of it so that we can make permanent a set of tax cuts that are really going towards a very small group amongst us. When you think about it, this imbalanced approach. What we're talking about is stripping healthcare, healthy food, housing, affordable housing from millions and millions of Americans. And in exchange, what we're offering is, on average, for a household that makes $96,000 or less, they're going to get an average of a $400 tax cut. For families within the 1%, those are those that make upwards of $740,000 a year, they're going to get $61,000 in tax cuts. So the tax cut is imbalanced, the pain is imbalanced, and we need folks to step up and reject this proposal.
I did want to ask you about the Democratic Party's response here and what could be done and what should be done to ensure that these major cuts to vital health care programs aren't cut off.
It is a math problem. And the truth is, in order to pass this budget reconciliation, the Republicans have to hold every single member of the GOP in line. And so what every listener can be doing and what every Democrat in the House should be doing is challenging these individuals with the stories of their own constituents and not letting them run away from the deep impact their decisions are going to have. Tomorrow, we have 500 impacted Americans going to D.C. to talk to their elected officials to share their stories. And everyone that's listening could follow suit. So if you're able to reach out to your member of Congress and let them know about the impact that these cuts can have on you, maybe members of your family, the impact that healthcare, housing, and food programs are going to have on our communities, on our hospitals, our families, and more. And it doesn't matter if your representative is a Republican or Democrat, all of them should hear as loudly as possible in this moment that we cannot trade trillions of dollars in tax cuts for the top 5% and leave most of Americans behind.
That was Ana Lilia Mejia, co-executive director of Popular Democracy in Action. Learn more about widespread opposition to the proposed Trump Republican cuts to Medicaid and SNAP by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Shunning the tradition of a U.S. president's first foreign trip to either Canada or Mexico, President Trump's first trip abroad of his second term was to the same place as his first term, the Middle East. The focus of Trump's four-day visit to the oil-rich Gulf monarchies of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates was on making deals. During his stay in Riyadh, Trump announced at least $600 billion in Saudi investments in America, including $142 billion worth of new arms purchases from American defense contractors. Throughout the trip, other deals were made, involving commitments to invest billions of dollars in American artificial intelligence data centers and agreements to sell high-tech U.S.-made AI chips to Gulf autocrats. Expanding Trump's family business ties in the Middle East was also on the agenda, with the president's sons making deals for luxury hotels, golf resorts, and a $2 billion investment in the Trump-inspired U.S. dollar-backed stablecoin. This, in addition to Trump accepting Qatar's gift of a $400 million 747 jet plane. It was notable that Trump didn't include a stop in Israel to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, with no substantive discussion or progress on renewing a ceasefire in Gaza, where Palestinian civilians continue to be slaughtered. The president appears to have sidelined Israel in negotiations with Iran on a new nuclear agreement, the lifting of long-standing sanctions on Syria, making a deal with the Houthi rebels to end the U.S. bombing of Yemen, and U.S. talks with Hamas that resulted in the release of the last living U.S. citizen held hostage in Gaza. Your reporter spoke with Raed Jarar, advocacy director with the group Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN, a nonprofit founded in September 2020 by Saudi U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi before his assassination ordered by the Saudi monarchy. Here, Gerard assesses the mixed outcome of Trump's recent trip to the Gulf states.
I mean, I think overall, the trip to the Middle East had mixed receptions and reviews. President Trump, before leaving to the Middle East, made a huge, earth-shattering decision that really broke decades of consensus in Washington, D.C. regarding Israel. And his decision was to reach to a unilateral truce with the Houthis in Yemen that did not include Israel. So in a way, this is the first time the U.S. government tells a regional player, we're not going to attack you if you don't attack us back. But if you want to attack Israel, go for it. Now, that decoupling of U.S. and Israel's national interest is unprecedented, literally unprecedented. We're talking about at least half a century where the United States worked as a protector for Israeli interests in the region. We saw how the previous administration under President Biden waged an entire war against Yemen that we didn't gain anything from. It was not an authorized war. The Houthis did not declare war on the United States. They didn't really attack the U.S. The Houthis one day woke up and said, we're going to start a front to pressure Israel to end its genocide, and we're going to attack Israeli interests and ships. So that declaration from President Trump was actually huge. It did not get as much coverage in the U.S. And his decision to normalize with the new Syrian government was also very big, and it did break also with what the Israeli government want, because Netanyahu has been bombing Syria almost every day for the past couple of months, with plans to dismantle Syria into smaller countries. So the U.S. normalizing relationships and lifting all sanctions on Syria in one step is actually unprecedented as well. So these many observers in D.C. and the region viewed these two steps as maybe a good opening for the Trump administration to be able to break decades of misguided U.S. foreign policy, where U.S. foreign policy put Israel first, to a new policy that, you know, Trump describes as an America first policy. I'm not necessarily a big fan of isolationism, but if that policy will actually break with the United States' addiction to its, you know, abusive allies in the region, that's welcome. And unfortunately, we saw the exact opposite when President Trump went there. The rhetoric and his speeches did not match the actions. The actions were indulging in corruption and U.S. relationships with abusive governments like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and others in the region, just to get more money and resources. In this case, more money and resources for the U.S., but also more money and resources for President Trump himself. A few billion dollars here and there of investments that would benefit him, an airplane here and there that he will take with him after his presidency. It was definitely like a return to the normal kind of corrupt politics where U.S. presidents fly to the region, dance and wine and dine with dictators who are killing their own people, because in the U.S. vision, these dictators are providing them in the United States with something that they need.
Right. I did want to address the issues you already spoke of, and that is Trump did not stop in Israel during this Middle East trip. And as you said, he seems to be pursuing an independent path from Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu in terms of renewed negotiations with Iran on the nuclear agreement that he's pursuing, as well as making a separate agreement with Hamas for the release of an Israeli-American hostage in Gaza.
That's right.
Netanyahu had ordered a blockade of all humanitarian aid into Gaza for some 11 weeks. And just today, Netanyahu announced a very small number of humanitarian aid trucks will be allowed to enter the territory. Netanyahu also announced Israeli troops will soon take full control of the Gaza Strip.
What's going on in Gaza is horrific. It is genocide that we are watching live on our screens. We wake up every day to horrific pictures of dead children and destroyed communities. And the United States has been complicit in this genocide since day one. The U.S. is definitely a partner in crime. President Biden and President Trump both have blood on their hands when it comes to the Israeli horrific violations that are committed, being committed every day.
That was Rai Jarrar, Advocacy Director with the group Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN. Find more analysis and commentary on Trump's Middle East policies by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Donald Trump was re-elected president in 2024, having escaped accountability in two impeachment trials, the first for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, stemming from his threat to withhold military aid to Ukraine unless that nation's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, cooperated in launching an investigation targeting Trump's political opponent and future president, Joe Biden. Trump's second impeachment was based on incitement of insurrection, for his central role in fomenting the violent January 6 assault on the U.S. Capitol to prevent certification of the 2020 election that Trump lost to Biden. The Senate acquitted Trump in both trials, failing to attain the necessary two-thirds vote. Now back in the White House, Trump is following through on his pledge to seek revenge against his political enemies, as he almost daily disregards foundational checks and balances on executive power enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, defies court orders, and violates federal ethics regulations. In his recent article, "Only a Democratic Constitution Can Stop Trumpism," Luke Pickrell, co-producer of the Democratic Constitution blog, examines the very deep flaws in our U.S. Constitution that's contributed to minority rule, that consistently empowers presidents, allows for the passage of legislation and Supreme Court rulings that don't represent the views of a majority of American voters. Here, Pickrell talks about the democratic deficiencies in the Constitution and his support for convening a constituent assembly to re-envision a new, more democratic governing structure.
One way that I approach this question is to think about the value of universal and equal rights, and especially the right to a vote, but also very importantly, an equal vote. And if one had to describe democracy, that's how I would do it, a system that ensures universal and equal rights, and particularly that aspect of an accessible and an equal vote. And that's what we don't have, thanks to our Constitution. We're trying to achieve a democracy in which there is a political system that ensures universal and equal rights, and that through that system, we would at least have the possibility of being able to start doing many of the things that we need to be doing. Also, as long as we don't have that system based on universal and equal rights and one person, one equal vote, we're at a constant disadvantage when it comes to fighting back against things that we don't like, when it comes to creating a better world. I think one way to describe the interest in the Constitution and viewing the Constitution as a problem is through that universal and equal rights, one person, one equal vote lens.
Well, Luke, I did want to ask you about particular campaigns, reform campaigns. There is a campaign to eliminate the Electoral College through something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. There's also proposals to either expand the number of Supreme Court justices or impose term limits on justices to better reflect majority views that you just mentioned. What are some other ways in which our Constitution can be reformed or updated to eliminate this curse of minority rule that creates really such anger and frustration, cynicism, among other things, that results in many voters disengaging from the political process and refusing to participate in what many now believe is a rigged system, a system that's broken, a system that's, you know, dysfunctional?
Sure. just to touch on one of your points, I agree that I think disengagement and disinterest in the political process has a lot to do with our undemocratic political system. I think countries that have the democratic features that I'm discussing, unicameral legislature in which there's essentially total legislative power, a court system that is accountable, basically in which majority desire is reflected, there's more political participation in those systems. In terms of going forward, I advocate in my articles and in my discussions with people for a constituent assembly, which I take from the work of Daniel Azaire, but other people too, which is basically just to say a convention managed through or with representatives elected by universal and equal suffrage that creates a new plan. And then if that plan is supported by a number majority of people, that then becomes the structure. A constituent assembly is very different from Article 5, in which the states are represented and not actually the people in terms of one person, one vote. It's also an open process, which is to say, just like the creation of our current constitution was illegal under the Articles of Confederation, this would also be in a process outside of the rules of the existing constitution. So when people ask, how can things be reformed? I don't think that reforms are possible within the existing rules. I don't think that there's a constitutional way out of this mess that we're in, so to speak.
That was Luke Pickrell, co-producer of the Democratic Constitution blog and podcast. He was interviewed by Richard Hill, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, and your reporter. Find a link to his Jacobin magazine article, Only a Democratic Constitution Can Stop Trumpism, and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WEFR in Fairmont, West Virginia, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KVRF in Wasilla, Alaska, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.